Thanks for listening to the AM 620 KPOJ podcast, sponsored by the Better World Club, providing travel services, auto insurance, and 24/7 nationwide roadside assistance, but not part of the highway lobby. This is Tom Hartman, Better World Club member since first moving to Oregon. Check out their eco benefits like the nation's only bicycle roadside assistance and their e-newsletter, Kicking Asphalt, at betterworldclub.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. The Obama administration. This is one of those, you know, good on you, Barack moments. President Obama, we need to refer to him respectfully and correctly. One of those very, very much, you know, good on you, sir, moments has laid out some of those secret legal opinions that were put together during the Bush administration that were, I don't know how to describe this as anything other than an attempt to subvert democracy in the United States. I just know of no other way to say it. And by the way, let me top of the hour, top of the show to you. Our quote today is from Alice Walker. Activism is my rent for living on this planet. What a great quote. Activism is my rent for living on this planet. And our telephone number, of course, 866-987-TOM, 987-THOM. That's 8466. Excuse me. And if you're calling from outside, if you're one of our web listeners and calling from outside the United States, we have a special couple of lines reserved for you, and please don't use them if you're in the United States, at 503-796-2324. So, anyhow, here's the secret. This from the International Herald Tribune, Neil Lewis writing today's paper. The secret legal opinions issued by Bush administration lawyers, we're talking John Yoo and company, from Berkeley, within the sound of my voice, after the September 11, 2001 attacks, included assertions that the president could use the nation's military within the United States to combat people deemed as terrorists and to conduct raids without obtaining a search warrant. Now, the first part of that is a violation of a law that was passed during Reconstruction after the Civil War called Posse Comitatus. That law said that the U.S. will never again use its army to point their guns at its citizens. We did that during the Civil War, and we said, we're going to make that illegal, henceforth, now, forever, world without end, amen. And we did, with the exception of about a year during the Bush administration when it actually got stripped out by the Military Commissions Act, and then it got put back in, although Bush put a signing statement on it saying, no, it's not, but anyhow, it is, I think. So, number one, the first part of that was a violation of Posse Comitatus. The second part of that, conduct raids without obtaining a search warrant, is a violation of the Fourth Amendment. You know, the Fourth Amendment, very straightforward and unambiguous. The Fourth Amendment is what we refer to as privacy. Now, the word privacy doesn't appear in the Constitution. The reason why is because back in the day, the word privacy meant use the bathroom. Seriously, in the days of Jefferson and Madison, when they were writing the Constitution, if somebody said, I need a moment of privacy, it was code for, I need to go to the outhouse. In fact, outhouses were referred to as privies. So using the word privacy in the Constitution would be like using the word toilet in the Constitution. In fact, the word toilet didn't even come into popular use until the late 19th century when the flush toilet was invented and then popularized by a guy named by the name of Thomas Crapper. But in any case, the Fourth Amendment, while it doesn't use the word privacy, it says it. It says the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue. In other words, the only way you can violate that right is with a warrant. And no warrants shall be issued but upon probable cause In other words, you've got to demonstrate that there's somebody's actually committing a crime. You have reasonable suspicion, probable cause to issue that warrant, supported by oath or affirmation. Somebody has to swear to it under oath, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. In other words, it has to be specific. Now, the head of our National Security Agency at the time, former Lieutenant General Michael Hayden, had no understanding of this. This is Michael Hayden speaking before Congress.
But does it not say probable?
The legal standard is probable cause.
Now,
my understanding is that the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution specifies that you must have probable cause.
Now, this is a reporter in a press conference talking to Michael Hayden, educating him about the Fourth Amendment. He says the Fourth Amendment says you must have probable cause. Listen to the head of the NSA, the spy agency. Why were they spying on us? Listen to Hayden's response.
To be able to do a search that does not violate an American's right against unlawful searches and seizures.
Fourth Amendment actually protects all of us against unreasonable search and seizure.
But the measure is probable cause, I believe.
The amendment says unreasonable search and seizure.
But does it not say probable?
See, you hear that? Does it not say probable cause? No. Well, I just read it to you, and that's the basis of the whole thing. Before you can bust into somebody's house, you have to have some sense that they're actually doing something wrong. So, anyhow, here we have these memos that, number one, the lawyers to the Bush administration were saying, you can tear up the Fourth Amendment, you can tear up posse comitatus, but then it gets even worse. And thank God the Obama administration believes in transparency in government. They're laying this stuff out. Among nine that were disclosed publicly for the first time Monday by the Justice Department in what the Obama administration portrayed as a step toward greater transparency, that opinion was included. And these were written by a number of government lawyers, particularly John Yoo and Jay Bybee. The opinion authorizing the military to operate on domestic territory was dated October 31st, 2001, and written by Yoo. This is the one that says posse comitatus doesn't matter. In fact, here's the exact language. You wrote this to Gonzalez. He says, the law has recognized that force, including deadly force, may be legitimately used in self-defense. Okay, we all agree with that. If somebody's coming at you with a gun and you've got a gun, you can shoot them first, if you're pretty sure that they're going to shoot you or if they've already taken a shot at you. Anyhow, his memo continues. Any objections based on the prohibition against unreasonable searches in the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution would vanish because any privacy offense that comes with such a search would be less than an injury from deadly force. In other words, because Osama bin Laden is trying to get us, we have the right to turn our military on our own citizens, to use deadly force against our own citizens, to snatch people from their homes in the middle of the night, and we can do it in violation of the Fourth Amendment. You and Delahunty also said in the October 23rd memorandum, First Amendment speech and press rights may also be subordinated to the overriding need to wage war successfully. These guys tore up the First and Fourth Amendment. Now, the Fourth Amendment guarantees privacy. The First Amendment guarantees free speech. Why are these things important? There are times when we all must challenge our own government. I mean, there actually are. There are times when it's appropriate to take on your own government. And Thomas Jefferson laid these out in the Declaration of Independence. He talked about the laws of nature and nature's God. He said, we hold these truths to be self-evident. And he goes through the stuff that Rush Limbaugh mangled the other day. And life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it. And he goes on to say that while evils are sufferable, when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them, that's the people, you and me, under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government. And so there are times when it is appropriate. In fact, the founders wanted us to challenge our government. For example, the Vietnam War. For example, the Iraq War. For example, the School of the Americas. On and on it goes. There are times when it is when speaking out is our obligation. These guys used torture. We know now that the CIA has destroyed 92 of these videotapes of torture. Why? Because torture was not used to extract information. Torture is an instrument of terrorism. It's a lousy way to get information, but it's a great way to terrorize everybody else. So what they were saying, essentially, is don't you become like Medea Benjamin with Code Pink and get out there and unfurl a banner in the White House, because we might just disappear you and you might be tortured. That was the essential message. Torture is a tool of governmental terrorism, and the Bush administration were terrorists. They were trying to terrorize Americans and others around the world. A society without dissent is a conservative paradise. And that's what they were trying to create, a society without dissent. So our question for the hour, why privacy? Why did the Bush administration commit these crimes? And why is it so vital that we not only know about them, as the Obama administration has laid out in the last 24 hours, why is it so vital that we have these rights?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Broadcasting for a change in America. It's Tom Hartman here with you. Remember James Comey? I mean, this is an example of the attempt to take over America. And by the way, your thoughts, if you want to comment on this, what should be done? Do we need a truth commission? The truth is starting to come out. It's clear that crimes were committed against the founders. These guys are spitting on the graves of Jefferson and Madison and Washington and even the conservatives like Alexander Hamilton and John Adams. They were all American patriots. They may have had slightly different visions of America, but they were all American patriots. And the Bush administration spat on their graves. Do we need a Truth and Reconciliation Commission? Do we need trials? Do we need an international tribunal? I mean, we haven't even gotten to the war crimes associated with Iraq. I'm talking about the crimes against the American people. These guys asserted, these lawyers, John Yoo and these lawyers, asserted to George W. Bush that in the middle of the night he could come to your house or his agents could come to your house or mine and banish us. Remember when John Ashcroft was the attorney general? They had already put into place, in fact, they put it into place before 9/11. They put into place a program where they could secretly spy on us. Now, I'm of the opinion that they did that not out of terrorism concerns, but because they wanted political intelligence. These guys, this is the same thing as Nixon. It's the Nixon paranoia. And the Justice Department had to review this from time to time. And James Comey is saying, you know, I was not real comfortable with that. I don't believe it was legal.
It was Wednesday, March the 10th, 2004.
And how do you remember that date so well?
He's talking to Schumer before Congress.
This was a very memorable period in my life, probably the most difficult time in my entire professional life. And that night was probably the most difficult night of my professional life. So it's not something I forget.
Okay. Were you present when Alberto Gonzalez visited Attorney General Ashcroft's bedside?
Yes.
And am I correct that the conduct of Mr. Gonzalez and Mr. Card on that evening troubled you greatly?
Yes.
Now, what he's laying out here is what happened. We know now the backstory because at the time he was not willing to talk about the details. But what was going on was there was this illegal spying program on you and me. An illegal spying domestic wiretapping operation that was going on. And probably not just wiretapping, reading emails and everything else. that was going on. The Justice Department under Ashcroft and Comey, Comey was the number two guy, had decided this is illegal and we're not going to do it anymore. Robert Mueller, the head of the FBI, had agreed this is illegal and we're not going to do it anymore. Ashcroft is stricken down with pancreatitis. He's in the hospital. He's loaded up on morphine. He might even die. Standing orders, no visitors. The only person with him is his wife. And Comey gets this phone call that says, you know, holy cow, this is incredible. Comey gets this phone call that from Ashcroft's wife that the president of the United States has called and said he's sending his guys down to sign the authorization to continue the wiretapping even after Ashcroft has said no.
The attorney general was taken that very afternoon to George Washington Hospital, where he went into intensive care and remained there for over a week. And I became the acting attorney general. And over the next week, particularly the following week on Tuesday, we communicated to the relevant parties at the White House and elsewhere our decision that as acting attorney general, I would not certify the program as to its legality, and explained our reasoning in detail, which I will not go into here, nor am I confirming it's any particular program. That was Tuesday that we communicated that. The next day was Wednesday, March the 10th, the night of the hospital incident, and I was headed home at about 8 o'clock that evening. My security detail was driving me, and I remember exactly where I was on Constitution Avenue, and got a call from Attorney General Ashcroft's chief of staff telling me that he had gotten
What's
a call.
His name?
David Ayers. That he had gotten a call from Mrs. Ashcroft from the hospital. She had banned all visitors and all phone calls. So I hadn't seen him or talked to him because he was very ill. And Mrs. Ashcroft reported that a call had come through and that as a result of that call, Mr. Card and Mr. Gonzalez were on their way to the hospital to see Mr. Ashcroft.
Do you have any idea who that call was from?
I have some recollection that the call was from the president himself, but I don't know that for sure. It came from the White House, and it came through, and...
He's couching it. He knows it was George W. Bush. Bush was trying to push through his police state. Bush was the criminal behind the criminals. How do we deal with this? Do we prosecute? We're talking about crimes against the United States. As I said, we're not even talking yet, perhaps for another day. I'm talking about crimes against the Constitution. Comey continues, he got this call, and he decides he's got to get there before Card and Gonzalez do.
So I hung up the phone, immediately called my chief of staff, told him to get as many of my people as possible to the hospital immediately. I hung up, called Director Mueller.
Of the FBI?
With whom I'd been discussing this particular matter, and who'd been a great help to me over that week, and told him what was happening. He said, I'll meet you at the hospital right now. Told my security detail that I need to get to George Washington Hospital immediately. They turned on the emergency equipment and drove very quickly to the hospital. I got out of the car and literally ran up the stairs.
So here he is. He's flashing lights on the way to the hospital. I'll tell you the rest of the story right after the break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Hi, folks. Tom Hartman here. Revitalizing democracy. Tom Hartman here with you. I think we all know how you deal with war crimes. I mean, you have trials and you convict people and you send them to prison. How do you deal with crimes against the Constitution? What should we do? about Andy Card and Alberto Gonzalez. Here's James Comey. He's sitting up with the bedside. He's used his siren and lights to get to the hospital and ran up the stairs before Gonzalez and Card get there. Ashcroft is sitting in his hospital bed. Comey is the acting attorney general now, although Ashcroft is you know, he's not actually even legally the attorney general because he's almost in a coma. And Comey sitting there in the gets to the hospital.
So I raced to the hospital room. Entered, and Mrs. Ashcroft was standing by the hospital bed. Mr. Ashcroft was lying down in the bed. The room was darkened, and I immediately began speaking to him, trying to orient him as to time and place and try to see if he could focus on what was happening, and it wasn't clear to me that he could. He seemed pretty bad off.
And at that point, it was you, Mrs. Ashcroft, and the Attorney General and maybe medical personnel in the room, no other Justice Department or government officials.
Just the three of us at that point. I tried to see if I could help him get oriented. As I said, it wasn't clear that I had succeeded. I went out in the hallway, spoke to Director Mueller by phone. He was on his way. I handed the phone to the head of the security detail, and Director Mueller instructed the FBI agents present not to allow me to be removed from the room under any circumstances.
So the head of the FBI and the acting attorney general get it that the president of the United States has just sent his henchmen, Andy Card as chief of staff and Alberto Gonzalez as attorney general, to try to get the incoherent attorney general, John Ashcroft, to commit a crime.
I sat down in an armchair by the head of the attorney general's bed. The two other Justice Department people stood behind me, and Mrs. Ashcroft stood by the bed holding her husband's arm, and we waited. And it was only a matter of minutes that the door opened and in walked Mr. Gonzalez carrying an envelope and Mr. Card. They came over and stood by the bed, greeted the Attorney General very briefly, and then Mr. Gonzalez began to discuss why they were there.
So Gonzalez goes over and he starts pitching Ashcroft, who's stoned out on morphine, and saying, you got to sign off on this thing so that we can spy on the Democrats, so that we can spy on Americans, so we can spy on Ted Kennedy. You got to sign off on this thing that you've already told us is illegal. It's a crime against the Fourth Amendment.
To seek his approval for a matter and explain what the matter was, which I will not do. And Attorney General Ashcroft then stunned me. He lifted his head off the pillow and in very strong terms expressed his view of the matter, rich in both substance and fact, which stunned me, drawn from the hour-long meeting we'd had a week earlier, and in very strong terms expressed himself, and then laid his head back down on the pillow, seemed spent, and said to them, but that doesn't matter because I'm not the Attorney General.
But he expressed his reluctance or he would not sign the statement that they give the authorization that they had asked. Is that right?
Yes.
In other words, Ashcroft says no, ain't going to happen.
Am I correct that it was Mr. Gonzalez who did just about all of the talking? Mr. Card said very little.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And they made it clear that that there was in this envelope an authorization that they hoped Mr. Ashcroft.
So you get this. I mean, it continues like this. You get this. Gonzalez, and they didn't succeed. So Bush continued to wiretapping people illegally. Well, it was illegal to begin with. But the Justice Department and the people at the FBI, Mueller at the FBI and Comey and Ashcroft at the Justice Department had said, you know, Mr. Bush, President Bush, what you want to do is a crime against the Constitution. How do we deal with criminals who have violated the Constitution? Not to mention, you know, the then let's get into the War Powers Act and war crimes. Gus in Huntington Beach. Hey, Gus, welcome to the show. What are your thoughts on all this?
Pretty much this narrative is moot because the wiretapping began before 9/11.
That's my point.
9/11 was the rationale that you and Addington came up with for the unitary presidency, you know, the inherent powers of the commander-in-chief.
Right.
So, you know, we really need to go back to before 9/11. We need a new 9/11 investigation. And one aside is that the reason that we don't have the information. You made the reference before that we won't get to the bottom of this for 30 years. And the reason we won't is the same reason that we didn't get to the bottom of the Kennedy assassination, is because we have been under a national security state since the National Security Act of 1947, which established the CIA not as a spy agency, but as a clearinghouse, just the same as Homeland Security is supposedly a clearinghouse.
For national security. Gus, I'm not disagreeing with you, and I agree that 9/11 needs to be reinvestigated. But the point is that these guys started violating the Constitution, breaking the Constitution, violating the Fourth Amendment, the right to privacy. And the reason that right to privacy is in there, people say, well, you know, hey, I'm not doing anything wrong. I don't care if there's 100 spy cameras on the street and they see me walking down the street. I don't even care if they see me walking into a porn shop or something. I'm not committing a crime. I'm not a criminal. Yeah, but what if you decide to take on your government? Not in a violent way, not in an illegal way, but what if you are one of the women in the Unitarian Church who, and not the men as well, of course, but the raging grannies, for example. What if you're one of the people in the Unitarian Church who are going out there protesting, who have been spied on by the government illegally under this act? I mean, they were pushing Ashcroft to spy on us. This is all about intimidation. This is the beginning of a Pinochet kind of regime. That's what's so wrong about this. Tim in Detroit. Hey, Tim, welcome to the show.
Well said about the Pinochet regime. It's clear to me that obviously the First and Fourth Amendments were violated pretty much from the start of the Bush administration. I mean, you had...
My point.
Clear.
So what do we do about it?
Well, it seems fairly clear to me, although I don't see it happening, is a prosecution, at least on constitutional grounds, regarding the First, Fourth, and maybe even the Fifth and Sixth Amendments. I mean, you could go...
And the Seventh and Eighth, if you want to, you know, Sixth, Seventh, and Eighth are the ones that all have to do with speedy trials, making bond, mm-hmm. trial by jury of your peers. None of those have happened to several U.S. citizens and people who have been snatched, or at least didn't happen in a speedy trial. Absolutely did not get
one. Well, Padilla, for example, didn't get any trial.
Yeah, Jose Padilla, yeah.
And what I wanted to say was that regarding the FISA bill that was passed back in August of 2008, I see that as also a violation of the Fourth Amendment, and that's still continuing.
I agree.
So isn't Obama also in violation of the Fourth Amendment as well?
I think so, and he voted for the FISA bill, and he's got some splaining to do on that account as well. So, you know, but we need to be, frankly, in my opinion, we need to be addressing these things. We need to go after, obviously, we need to go after the war crimes. That's the low-hanging fruit. Frankly, I think if we don't do that, you know, you're going to have a half a dozen other countries in line to do that. But what about protecting our Constitution? Mike in Portland. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on. I wanted to point out, though, that a lot of this is going to be moot. It's going to be moot in just a few short days. The statute of limitations on some of the very events that you were describing is a five-year statute on some of these crimes.
On some of them, yes.
But, so, I mean, if we really want this dealt with, we need to grab the torches and pitchforks now. There needs to be a million people out on the White House lawn demanding that the Justice Department under Obama proceed against these people.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And this is how bad, Mike well said, and this is how bad it is. I mean, this is Comey describing how little he trusted the mafia. The organized crime ring that was running out of the White House, that was Andy Card, Alberto Gonzalez, and George W. Bush, as he said.
An agent came up to us and said that I had an urgent call in the command center, which was right next door. They had Attorney General Ashcroft in the hallway by himself, and there was an empty room next door that was the command center. And he said it was Mr. Card wanting to speak to me. I took the call. Mr. Card was very upset. And demanded that I come to the White House immediately. I responded that after the conduct I had just witnessed, I would not meet with him without a witness present. He replied, "What conduct? We were just there to wish him well." And I said again, "After what I just witnessed, I will not meet with you without a witness, and I intend that witness to be the Solicitor General of the United States."
That would be Mr. Olson.
Yes, sir. Ted Olson. Until I can connect with Mr. Olson, I'm not going to meet with you. He asked whether I was refusing to come to the White House. I said, "No, sir, I'm not. I'll be there. I need to go."
So, yeah, to make a long story short, he doesn't even go to the White House until he's got Ted Olson with him, until he's got his witness. and then George Bush won't meet with him. Then it's Andy Card ranting and raving at him. I mean, these are crimes against the Constitution. This stuff, and these hearings, by the way, are from a couple of years ago. But the information that we've got now is a consequence of what was released yesterday by the White House, that this was part and parcel of a woof and weave of one entire program of torturing, kidnapping American citizens without a warrant, spying on people. You know, which violates the Fifth, Sixth, and Seventh Amendments. You know, holding them in detention, not giving them a trial, not giving them access to their accusers. Violating the Fifth, Sixth, Seventh, and Eighth Amendments. Violating the Fourth Amendment, our right to privacy. Violating the First Amendment, our right to free speech and our right to public assembly. This is the essence of privacy that these guys were trying to strip apart. Now, Obama's putting it back together, but we've got to highlight these crimes.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Tom Hartman here. You've heard me talk a lot.
.org.
Shaking up the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here. Tom Hartman broadcasting live coast to coast. And our Higgins alert for the day, our cat alert. Y'all know I have a crazy cat named Higgins. He's an attack cat. He attacks everybody that gets within sight of him, except for me and Louise. And sometimes he's not quite sure about Louise. Although, yeah, he's pretty good to her because she feeds him, but follows me around like a dog. But everybody else, they get near him. Well, apparently there was a fellow in Omaha, Nebraska, who had a similar cat. This guy, he had 20-year-old Asiya Shoemaker was his name. And he decided that the way to solve the problem, I don't see it as a problem. I kind of like having an attack cat. But he decided that the way to solve the problem of his hyperactive cat was thus. He built a glass box about 12 inches by 6 inches, attached to this box, or plastic box, attached to the box a garden hose, stuck his cat in the box, got some pot fired up, took a couple of deep tokes, and blew them down the garden hose to fill the box with smoke to get his cat stoned. First of all, I can't even imagine. I mean, you know, you give Higgins a little catnip, and he gets very affectionate. And if you get near him to pet him while he's affectionate, he will take your hand off. I would hate to see him on. There you go. I'd hate to see him on pot. I mean, heaven only knows. So strange stuff of the day. What can you say? John in Los Angeles, listening on K Talk. Hey, John, what's on your mind today? John?
Hey, Gary.
Hey,
yeah,
John.
I'm here.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Had to get you potted up there. What's up?
Yeah. I was in the military, and you take an oath to uphold the Constitution, just like the president does when he's sworn in.
That's right. And by the way, because George W. Bush constantly said, I took an oath to protect the people of the United States. He didn't. The presidential oath is to protect the Constitution, and that's what I've been talking
exactly.
about this entire hour about their violating. Continue, sir.
Exactly. So and if somebody in the military didn't do as they were told, it would be considered an act of treason. They would be tried and put to death. And I think that's what needs to be done to set an example so this doesn't happen in the future.
Well, I'm a little reluctant to see Alberto Gonzalez, Andy Card, and George W. Bush put to death over this, but I think that being put into
prison. They should put it on pay-per-view.
Yeah, I think putting them in prison is probably a very good idea. John, thanks for the call. Chris in San Francisco, listening on Green 960. Hey, Chris, your thoughts on how do we deal with people who have shredded the Constitution?
Well, Tom, first of all, I think it comes down, as a lot of things do in our government, to public will. Or maybe more appropriately, a perception of public will. Because we now have a Congress that refuses to enforce a subpoena against Karl Rove. And Karl Rove is nobody, and he's thumbing his nose at the entire Congress. They've subpoenaed him out 3 times.
Yeah.
And he just chooses not to go. So if Congress won't even enforce a subpoena against Karl Rove, it's I think there's a far deeper reaching, more insidious problem. And I think what it comes down to is that people have to, first of all, have the education and the cognitive awareness of our Constitution and what our government's supposed to mean. And then they have to have the will to call their representatives and say, if you don't fulfill your oath to the Constitution, which they take, as everybody in federal service does, because I was in the military too and I took an oath. If they let their representatives know, if you're not willing to enforce or to fulfill your oath to the Constitution, I'll find somebody else, you know?
Yeah.
And that's great. You know, people in San Francisco have Nancy Pelosi and she's the Speaker of the House, but I think they need to call her up and say, you know, I'll settle for Cindy Sheehan if that's what it comes down to.
Yeah,
you know,
because these guys violated the Constitution. Chris, excellent point. 866, by the way, our telephone number, 987. Nice numbers. 987-THOM. 987-THOM. Here's James Comey. Kind of summarizes. Again, this is the guy who at the time was the acting Attorney General of the United States, summarizing how Andy Card and Alberto Gonzalez, George W. Bush, makes the phone call to Ashcroft's room, tells his wife he's sending his goons over and he better sign this document. I mean, talk about Godfather, right?
You told Mr. Card that you were very troubled by the conduct from the White House room, and that's why you wanted Mr. Olson to accompany you without giving any of the details, which we totally respect in terms of substance.
This is Schumer asking the question, by the way.
Just tell me why. What did you tell him that's so upset? That so upset you, or if you didn't tell him, just tell us.
I was very upset. I was angry. I thought I just witnessed an effort to take advantage of a very sick man who did not have the powers of the Attorney General because they had been transferred to me. I thought he had conducted himself, and I said to the Attorney General in a way that demonstrated a strength I had never seen before, but still I thought it was improper. And it was for that reason I thought there ought to be somebody with me if I'm going to meet with Mr. Card.
Yeah, there you go. 866-987-TOM, 987-THOM, Janice in Long Beach. Hey, Janice.
Hi, Tom. First, I have to thank you. I know everybody does, but you know what? We really mean it.
Oh, thank you. It's not necessary. It truly isn't.
I know, but I can't help myself. I appreciate you so much. And thank you for playing those hearings again. And the more I hear it, the more I am just chilled to the bone that we didn't.
These guys were trying to turn us into a Stalinist state, Janice. And they nearly
absolutely
did.
Absolutely. I just can't believe we haven't reacted more. And honestly, now we're so broke that my husband and I have talked about it. If we had a dime, two dimes to rub together, we would drop everything and go to Washington, D.C. right now. But you know what? They have us right where they want us.
This is why they wanted to destroy the middle class. For 28 years, they've been working to destroy the middle class because they don't want a politically active American citizenry that will push back against this. I mean, keep in mind, Ashcroft and Comey and Louis Freeh, the head of the CIA or the FBI, they were all Republicans, and they were saying this is a crime.
I know. Like I say, there are a lot of us out who are beside ourselves and can't afford to do a darn thing. We can't even afford to hitchhike.
Yeah, well, what you can't afford to do is you can check out. We're going to have to redirect our Call Congress page. We had a callcongress.org. I don't think it goes to the same page anymore. We're redoing our website at tomhartman.com, and we're working the bugs up. But there are toll-free numbers for Congress. You can call your member of Congress. You can call the local office and say, do something about this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Thanks for listening to the AM 620 KPOJ podcast, sponsored by the Better World Club. Providing travel services, auto insurance, and 24/7 nationwide roadside assistance, but not part of the highway lobby. This is Tom Hartman, Better World Club member since first moving to Oregon. Check out their eco benefits like the nation's only bicycle roadside assistance and their e-newsletter, Kicking Asphalt, at betterworldclub.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. broadcasting live from coast to coast. Edmund Heiselmeyer is with us. He is a senior research fellow in health policy studies and domestic policy at the Heritage Foundation, heritage.org, the website. Edmund, am I pronouncing your name right? Sean, can Edmund, hang on just a minute. I forgot to put you on the air. My fault.
Oh, okay.
am I pronouncing you right?
Yeah, Heiselmeyer is correct.
Heiselmeyer, thank you very much. You have written a piece, or actually, I guess it was Robert Moffat wrote a piece for the Heritage Foundation, talking about this 8-point plan and raising some concerns about it. One, you note, or the Heritage Foundation notes there, that so far what we have depends on raising taxes and saving money largely through administrative payment changes in existing entitlement programs. That's not exactly fundamental reform. I think we can agree on that, although isn't it an appropriate starting point to fix the stuff around the edges?
I'm not sure it is. In fact, I was thinking about this the other day and I may actually write something on this, that President Obama may have actually got himself off on the wrong foot by putting more money on the table, because in effect that tells the interest groups, hey, we don't have to worry about reform. It's just going to be more of the same.
Well, this is one of my big concerns, too. And in fact, apparently in his meetings, he's not including people who are representing single payer health care plans, which is what I advocate and what I suspect you view with horror. But he's going to try and walk this middle ground. And I think if you walk the middle ground, you're going to get eaten alive by billion-dollar insurance companies.
Yeah, well, it's not the insurance companies that are the issue, really, in my view. The issue is really the providers, and particularly...
You mean the doctors?
But particularly the hospitals.
The for-profit hospitals.
No, it doesn't matter whether they're for-profit or not-for-profit. They all behave the same.
By and large, you're right.
No, they do, and this is based on the work that I did with the folks in Massachusetts, and then, you know, I've been working with a lot of different states on this, and my observations on this are that 90% of this is interest group politics, and part of the reason that I would attribute Massachusetts to succeeding in being an innovative reform that achieved goals that both the left and the right want is that they were starting from a point of saying, well, we have to do better with what we're spending now.
But from what I'm hearing, Massachusetts is not succeeding.
Oh, no, it is succeeding. I mean, good grief.
There are more people insured, but, you know, this is nothing close to universal health care yet.
Well, actually, it's incredibly close. It's closer than anybody else in the country. In fact,
what about Hawaii?
I think it's actually closer than Hawaii because of a number of factors there. But they have had a remarkable improvement in terms of the insurance coverage. They enrolled in Medicaid and SCHIP 97,000 people who were eligible but not enrolled. They have provided coverage to 175,000 people who were not eligible for those programs but are still below 300% of poverty through the Commonwealth Care Program. They have a further 200,000 who have simply taken up private coverage that they had access to but figured, well, if somebody else will pay when I go to the hospital, why bother?
Right.
They're running out of people to insure in that state.
Yeah. And many of these are government programs, which you know, I would assume, being with the Heritage Foundation, you would be opposed to.
Well, not per se. I mean, again, this is the question: is what kind of a system are you trying to create? And
right.
If you're setting about reform, what kind of system are you trying to create? My view, and that of my colleagues here at the Heritage Foundation, is that we want a patient-centered, value-maximizing system. Now, what does that mean? That means that right now in the system, everybody else's interests come first ahead of the patients. The employers who buy the insurance, the government who runs the insurance program for those who have a government program, they run it their way, the doctors, the hospitals, et cetera. The insurance companies who work for either the government or the employer. We want a system that says, hey, all of you people have to work for the patient.
Right. Well, and the insurance companies actually don't work for the government or the employer. They're paid by the government.
Well,
employer.
But they work
for their stockholders. That's the problem.
Well, okay. But at the end of the day, I mean, yeah. I mean, do you work for your stockholders? Do you work for your customer? You could say that about any business. The point is, if you want more customers, you do what the customer wants. And so when an insurance company works for the government or the employer as the customer, what the customer wants is to spend less. Well, if there's easy ways to spend less money in healthcare, you know, don't pay for it or pay the docs and hospitals less. But that's not what you or I want. We want better value. We want to say, well, wait a minute, I want good care at a good price.
What about starting out? Let's back up just a little bit here and take this to a larger picture. We're talking with the Heritage Foundation Senior Research Fellow in Health Policy Studies, Edmund Heiselmeyer, and heritage.org, of course, the website. In the Declaration of Independence that Rush Limbaugh so badly mangled and attributed to the preamble of the Constitution this last weekend at CPAC, where I was, actually, not at that particular moment. I managed to avoid his speech, but I was there doing my show on Thursday and Friday. Thomas Jefferson took John Locke's famous phrase from his second treatise on government, life, liberty, and private estate, and changed it to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and wrote it into the Declaration of Independence as a fundamental right, as one of the reasons why this country was founded. If we were to assume that the right to life is a fundamental right that should be protected by our government, protected by the Constitution, it's one of our rights just as real as our right to free speech and our right to privacy, our right to a speedy trial. The right to life, even though it's not enumerated in the Bill of Rights, Alexander Hamilton wrote so eloquently, and I think it was Federalist 84, just because something isn't in the Bill of Rights. In fact, he didn't even think there should be a Bill of Rights because people might think that those were the only rights we had. Doesn't mean that it's not there. If there is a right to life in the United States, shouldn't there be some absolute minimum baseline where if anybody in this country gets sick in any way under any circumstances, they can get well, that after all being life, they can get well at essentially no cost or very little cost to them, regardless of their economic station? Are you willing to agree with me on that point?
No, I mean, there's a lot of things that you have a problem with on that, because, I mean, how do you define get well, given that we're all eventually going to die of something?
Sure.
You know, how do you, you know, there's a lot of definitional issues with that.
If you're 35 years old and you get appendicitis.
Well, let's back up into the practical reality. The practical reality is, because we have this sort of academic debate over health care, and I get asked this all the time.
Well, actually, this isn't academic. I'm just asking, do you think that there's a right to life in the United States? Is there a right to health care in the United States, or is it a privilege?
Well, and again, that's what I say when I get asked that. Is I say, look, that's not the way I would put it. What I would put it is, it's a desirable social good. In other words, we want to have health care for ourselves. No, it's not privilege. There's a difference. We want to have health care for ourselves, and we want everybody else to have it too. And I think we can agree on that without getting into a debate on a philosophical conception of right.
No, this isn't some airy-fairy philosophical thing, Edmund. Because if we start with the premise and start at law with the premise that health care is a right, then the way that the government approaches health care becomes very different than if we start with the premise that it is a desirable social good, to use your phrase, or a privilege, to use the phrase of some of the people in the Republican Party.
Well, I don't think that they use the phrase of privilege, but what is it a right to?
Several of them have on this show.
Well, what is it a right to? I mean, you're right. You do approach it a different way. I'm just not sure that you get something, you know, health reform out of it.
Well, in the minute we have left, how would you best accomplish this, in your opinion, at Heritage Foundation?
Well, what I would envision is a market in which the insurance companies work for you and me. You pick them. They become your agent in what you want, which is, okay, I need medical care. What's the best for me?
What if you have a pre-existing condition and all of them say, sorry, I'm not going to take you?
No. This is a reformed market where they would have to take you, just like they do an employer market today. But they work for you, and your interest is in getting better quality care at a better price, and you're picking them based on, well, what are you going to do for me? So they become your agent in doing this. And then I would be happy to use any one of a number of different means to extend that to everyone in the country by making sure people can afford it.
Yeah, but you want to keep the health insurance companies in business.
Well, I want to keep them working for, I want them to work for me instead of the employer.
Right, but the market there. I get it. Edmund Heisemeyer, the website heritage.org, senior research fellow in health policy studies. Edmund, thanks a lot for dropping by today.
Okay, thank you.
Great conversation. Our number, 866-987-THOM. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Men, are you waking up to your...
10-4.
For your brain, it's the Tom Hartman radio program. Does not, however, lead to stiff thinking. Welcome back. Our phone number, 866-987-TOM, 987-THOM. That's 866-987-8466. And Chris in Portland. Chris, welcome to the show.
Oh, hey. Hi, Tom Hartman.
Hi, Chris.
Yeah, I was just listening to that guy talk that was the, I think the guy from the Heritage Foundation, he's maybe from an insurance company too, and he said that he wanted to stay doing what the customer wants, and then he was kind of intimating that maybe the way to fix the system was to pay docs less or to do less, and he didn't want to talk about the overhead, and then you were kind of nailing him a little bit about, you know, whether medicine is a right or a privilege, and he certainly wasn't coming down on the side of it being a right.
I think that's where the argument has to begin. That's where the discussion has to begin. If we don't have that discussion, then everything else is going
absolutely
to be nibbling around the edges.
And then after that, what? You know, the devil's in the details. But in the New York Times, the Science Times today, they talked, there's a great thing called the hurdle for health reform, patients and their doctors. And it talks about doctors who trade up to expensive migraine drugs when they don't need to, and also to that patients and doctors together shape the way that medical care is delivered, and they demand what they believe, the patients demand what they believe to be the best possible care. But in fact, it often isn't. It's just the newest or the most expensive or the latest or the highest technology. And really, if it's at the ground level, I've been dying to call you for a long time. I'm an ER doctor in Portland. And
you're an ER doc.
And at the ground level, if prescriptions and procedures were needed, the kind of things that were given to make you healthy and well, that it would be a far different kind of a market system that you would use. And I'm hopeful that with this new change in administration, and my major point for calling is that I've just finished in the last 2 years a teaching fellowship with Andrew Weil out of the University of Arizona, Integrative Medicine Department.
Yeah.
He's just a regular, intern, or actually just a, primary care kind of doctor who made it his business to put together a fellowship for integrative medicine.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with it. My old friend Louis Malmadrona used to co-teach that with him.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, it's a great thing. 1,000 hours, 2 years going down and meeting his people and now having access to him. And, this guy that was the past surgeon general that quit under Bush, Corona or whatever it was, Cardona, something like that, he spoke at our graduation, and he said basically that, we need to change medicine and the way it's delivered. That's obvious. And what I would hope, and I know that it can't happen because, they're never going to have Andrew Weil be the Surgeon General because of his past history. The confirmation would be outrageous probably, but at any rate, it isn't going to happen. But 80 doctors every 2 years comes out of there. There are now 400 of us that have been trained on putting together clinics for integrative medicine. Now, out of the ER at Kaiser, what we notice is that many people come in over and over again for the same problems. And there's just this level of prescription of drugs that just seems to ascend. And they say by the time you're 80, you'll have one prescription for at least a decade of your life, so you have at least 8 medicines. It's
wow.
a chemical soup that nobody knows. Many people are on 13. I've met a guy on 27 medications.
Whoa.
It happens all the time, and it's more common than not that somebody
right.
has medication. And this is just the wrong way to do it. But here in this paper, they finally nailed down the real problem is that, you know, you can't – it's I digress, but there's this great guy that just died, Wendell Wyatt. And when he was a representative for our state, and he had on his, he just had a memorial this last Saturday,
mm-hmm.
and he said, a representative owes you not his industry, but his judgment,
yeah.
and he betrays instead of serving you.
Chris, let me ask you a question. As an ER physician,
yeah.
what percentage of the people who show up in the emergency rooms that you work in are presenting with genuine emergencies versus things that they should be going to a primary care physician or even a specialist for, but aren't because they don't either have insurance or the insurance they have is so filled with deductibles and gotchas and weirdnesses
right.
that they find it easier to show up at the ER?
Well, it isn't just that, Tom. I would say 20-80, and I hate to be that.
20-80, 20% actual emergencies or 80%
well,
actual emergencies?
20% admission rate, and so those are the people that are pretty bad off, and maybe
wow.
80% that could maybe have made it till the next morning to a primary. But here's the other problem. A lot of times it's the urgent, you know, the prudent layperson law. If you think you have an emergency, you have an emergency. We are not all doctors. If you think you've got something wrong,
sure. see a know, doc.
So maybe they should be at least at 50% of the people that are there should be there.
Yeah.
But, you know, emergencies, urgencies, and convenience care. It's
but isn't it terrible? I mean, we've got, and like we have Zoom Care in this town, zoomcare.com. I mean, there's these docs, they'll see you in an hour. They've even got a website at zoomcare.com. You can go right to them. And I've used them. It's wonderful. But, yeah, and they're popping up, things like that are popping up around the country. But, again, you've got to have decent insurance in order to be able to use these things by and large. I mean, you know, Zoom Care is a reasonable price, but without health insurance, so many people are finding that the emergency room is like their place, the place that they end up. Chris, thank you for the call. I'm sorry we have to take a break here, but your thoughts are well said and well taken. And Andrew Weil is one of my personal heroes. He's written some brilliant books. And one of his oldest and original was From Chocolate to Morphine. That's a hoot. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Shaquille O'Neal.
Radio for the sane among us. Drop by. Yeah, come on in. Time for our Limbaugh alert for the day.
Condescending tribes making money selling lies. You might say, everybody hates my guts. I'm offensive, I'm a bigot, I'm a fraud. Can you dig it? I'm a sexist, racist, homophobic, fat, pathetic cuss.
And now we find the liberals doing what they always do, and I've told you this, they always try to give me 50 milligrams of Vicodin instead of the 80s.
I'm a Nazi.
Oh, man, did you see that guy at CPAC? You know, brushing his hands against each other and what, moving around and it's like, whoa, had enough Coke Rush, I mean, or something. I mean, it's talk about high. In any case, this is a very, very interesting conversation that David Letterman and Katie Couric had last night about the Rushster. And
what about this bonehead Rush Limbaugh? Honest to God. I mean, what is going on there?
Don't do this to me, please.
No, because...
Don't do this to
now,
me.
He gets up in Washington, and he's the keynote speaker at some function, and he comes up, he looks like an Eastern European gangster. You know, he's got the black jacket on, silk shirt, and it's unbuttoned like, oh, yeah. When you think Rush Limbaugh, you think, ooh, let's see a little flesh.
Yeah, that's our Limbaugh. In closing,
let me say that each and every day, I'm an evil, rotten, egotistical snob. I'm the cop of the cop.
This is the guy who has been defined as the intellectual force of the GOP.
With the equivalent compassion of a grump.
Yeah, it's a little scary. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, 866-987-TOM, or 866-987-8466. Also, if you're calling from outside the United States, our number 503-796-2324. And Richard in Oakland, California. Hey, Richard, what's on your mind today? Richard, you're on the air.
Tom, hello? Are you there?
I'm here.
Couple of questions. Second question is, which one of your books you would recommend as a first buy of all your books that's most current? But let me. My first question is, people would say that if they raised the income limit on Social Security contributions, it would pretty much solve all the problems of Social Security and Medicare. Is that true? And if
yes.
So, why aren't people talking about it?
They're not talking about it because it would mean raising taxes on people who earn over $100,000 a year,
yeah,
which
what's
is
wrong with that?
Which is every member of Congress and every single talking head you see on TV.
Self-interest.
Yeah.
Well, I as a retired insurance agent, I think the insurance companies should be put to death, kind of, for all the things that they've done. And I'm, of course, my income is up there, but at the same time, I'm retired, so it wouldn't affect me. Maybe I have a double standard. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, I think that most people, I think it was very interesting that people who earn over $250,000 a year, which is a relatively small number of people, it's in the neighborhood of less than a million people in the United States, it's in the neighborhood of less than 3 million people in the United States, the number of people making over $3 million a year, which used to be the old 91% tax rate, is less than 300,000 people in the United States. Anyhow, that group of people voted for Barack Obama.
Yeah.
In other words, that group of people is saying, you know, we're doing very well, thank you very much, and we're doing well because we've got a country that was put together well, and if we can put this thing back together, we can continue doing well even if our taxes go up a little bit.
They did, historically. It worked that way. So two other quick questions. One is, which one of your books you would recommend as a first buy for somebody?
I would start with Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class. It's one of my more recent books. It's a good overview of economics and politics.
All right. And then the other one is... any comment? I guess a survey was run recently and said the highest use of pornographic, the state that uses the most of it is Utah.
That's right. That's
Speaking of double standards, kind of interesting.
Right. Yeah. In fact, we were going to do that as one of our crazy alerts. The state of Utah and the red states, by and large, tend to use more porn than the blue states.
I love it.
I do too. I find it entertaining. Richard, thanks a lot for the call. Another book, by the way. Just while we're on the topic, I have a book coming out in a couple of months called Threshold, The Crisis of Western Culture. And you can pre-order that over at Amazon and from your local bookstore. And they may have it at Powell's.com, too. I'm not sure, but you may want to check that out. Alan in Beverly Hills. Hey, Alan, what's on your mind?
Hi. A few points I'd just like to say real quickly. I've said it before. The Justice Department should investigate, call grand jury, and indict Bush and Cheney. And all the talk and all the hearings, do it. Just do that. They can do it.
Yeah.
Legislation, I would if I was the president, I'd bring in the leaders, both houses, and say, look, we need to get our legislation passed. The House is going to pass it. We should use and I would change the name, not nuclear option. I'd call it CLC, Constitution Legislative Change. And the Democrats should use the CLC, the Constitution.
Yeah, we've only had the filibuster rule since 1917.
Right.
It was changed in the 60s, the 70s, whenever it was. And we can change it. We can do away with it. We can say, hey, listen, you know, yes, it's a deliberative body and all that kind of thing.
Right.
But 50 votes is 50 votes. The majority rule is the United States. Absolutely right. And you know, we need to get it right. We need to get it right for all of our people. Paul in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Well, what I'd like to say with respect to the health care is alternative health care should be considered.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the other thing is I think it's criminal that there is profit made on people's illnesses and accidents and what have you.
Yeah.
I have no problem with healthcare providers, doctors, nurses, and everybody else that works in healthcare. But to be making a profit, have it on private business and stock markets, forget it.
Yeah, and here's the problem that gets brought into that. I mean, there has to be a delicate balance, Paul, and we've got to figure out how to make this happen. For example, you've got drug companies. First of all, most of the primary pharmaceutical research that's done in the United States is not done by the pharmaceutical companies. It's done in universities around the United States, and it's funded by the government, by the National Institutes of Health. Secondly, you've got drug companies that are playing the patent game. When the patent on a drug runs out, then they figure out a way to change a molecule or two so that the drug still does the same thing, but they can call it a brand new drug. They can give it a slightly different name or a new improved version so that they can keep it as a trade name drug and continue jacking the price way up. And that is not serving anybody's interest except the pharmaceutical companies and their stockholders. On the other hand, we do want, you know, somebody sitting around saying, how can we invent a new MRI machine that works better than the old MRI machine? How can we make a CAT scanner that produces less radiation and a better image? How can we make pharmaceuticals that are more effective and have fewer side effects? And, you know, the profit motive actually does go a long way in that. There has to be some way, though, to balance it. And I think it's much like the stock market where we say, you know, yeah, we need a stock market so that people can buy and sell stocks. People can change their investments. And the stock market isn't even primarily used to fund companies. You know, the vast majority, I don't know the percentage, but I'd say it's probably well over 99% of all stocks that are bought. Not a penny of it goes to the company of whom the stock is. If you buy GE stock right now or GM stock or any other stock on the open market, none of that money is going to the GE or GM or any other company. It's going to some other stockholder. It's buying and selling those things. So there needs to be some reasonable limits. Like, for example, the STET tax, a tax on individual transactions within the stock market to slow down the velocity of money flying around and the general craziness in the stock market. I think that that's just a healthy thing. Teresa, thanks for the call. Teresa in Dallas, Texas. Hey, Teresa, what's up?
How are you doing? I'm a great fan.
Thank you.
Question: who pays the senators? Is it the government?
Yeah, they're on the federal payroll, then senators.
We need to stop paying all these Republicans so they can stop working.
if they don't want government waste.
If they don't like the government waste, then they need to stop taking a check.
You know, I've always found it weird. Ever since Reagan came into office and started running against government itself, mm-hmm. I thought it was really weird. You know, why would he want to be president if he hates government? Why
exactly.
would he put Bill Bennett in charge of the Education Department when Bill Bennett thought that there should be no Education Department? It makes no sense.
Yes, the other thing I want to say is, did you hear how offensive Rush Limbaugh is to women? How can he say that, well, we just get paid to have children?
Yeah, Limbaugh's comments about women are
and the people who are laughing behind that, surely I wouldn't want to imagine there were women sitting in that hall where he was talking.
Yeah.
Because that should be offensive to them, if not their children.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, and
it makes me feel irate because I'm a foreigner, mm-hmm. and I know what it means when a man just degrades you when he just talks the way he talks. I mean, it gives me a chill. I feel like breaking on my TV and saying, you know what, I need to go get him myself.
Yeah. Well, Limbaugh, some of his more recent and bizarre comments, and you know he's doing it just to get an audience. He's
he
doing
wants
it just
an
to...
attention. He has attention deficit. That's what I should say.
Well,
and Sean Hannity, I think they have attention deficit disorder and they need some help.
Yeah. I would be the first to cop to having ADD. I think it goes beyond that. But his comment, for example, that the women's rights movement was just for unattractive women. You know, his comments, his use of feminazi, you know, is
very, very sad. If that's what the GOP has, oh my God.
Yeah.
I they're going to be in exile for a while.
Yeah, well, I think that Rahm Emanuel and Barack Obama are brilliant in casting Limbaugh, and thank you for the call, Teresa, in casting Limbaugh in the role of the intellectual senior of the GOP. And then, all the Republicans are going, yep, 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 bring him on. Hey, let's have him give the keynote speech at CPAC. Yeah, more of it. More of it. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Hi, folks. Tom Hartman here.
Once I ran a big bank, I had it made, bundling that old subprime. And now that my fat bonus is already paid, brother, can you spare me another trillion? Wearing our Armani threads, gee, we look swell, full of derivative loot. But then we all fled as the stock market fell. I was the kid with the golden parachute. Remember my bailout? Okay, it was a con. I took you for a bunch of billions. Well, thanks, sucker, for the bailout. But now it's gone. Buddy, can you spare another trip?
Yeah, they're only making, you know, a couple million bucks a year, these guys. I mean, it's tough work. It's tough, tough work. By the way, here's that clip the last caller and I were discussing of Mr. Limbaugh discussing the status of women in society. And if I can cue it up here.
I have long told you, for example, Undeniable Truth of Life number 24, written back in 1987, feminism was established so as to allow unattractive women easier access to the mainstream of society. And even to this day, people poo-poo this and say it's insensitive. How could you possibly say something like that? Well, because I mean it, because I believe there's something to it.
And this is the guy also who says,
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
So not only does he want to roll back the New Deal of the 1930s, he wants to roll back the women's equality movement that started with the American Revolution. Bob Ney on the line with Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Bob, good morning, or afternoon, or wherever you are, whatever
yes,
it is.
Yes, hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm just great. Hey, listen, I saw the movie The International the other day, which is a thinly veiled portrayal of the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, BCCI. Have you seen the movie?
No, I haven't.
It's great.
I have to watch it.
Yeah, it's a great thriller movie. And what most people, I think, don't know is, it's first of all that the Bush family was in thick with BCCI. There are big connections with both the Bush Senior and Bush Junior, but a number of BCCI's investors. One of whom helped bail out one of George Bush's companies. But beyond that, that the guy who outed the whole thing, the whole BCCI thing that led to its downfall, was John Kerry in congressional hearings, and he took an enormous amount of heat for it. Now John Kerry, I understand, is going after the banks again. Only this time, it's not the banks who are the mafia banks; it's the banks who are the basic, just good old fashioned generic thief banks.
That's correct, and that's going to be Kerry and Dorgan are both involved with it, and it's really huge frustration around the country with what's going on with Wall Street, and so now John Kerry is taking up the cause to do something with it, and he plans to introduce legislation, and it would prohibit any bank that receives government cash from hosting, sponsoring, paying for conferences, parties, entertainment events, flying people around. And they're looking at, of course, the billions that have been given to these companies. And so he's actually out there saying, this isn't going to continue as it has.
Yeah. To what extent do you think this is sound and fury signifying nothing versus the beginning of some real action?
I believe this is the beginning of real action. What has been going on, and with the AIG $30 billion on top of the $150 billion, and people are starting to, look at this around the country, and still seeing that, under Bush, the banks refused to tell, where the money's coming from. Now the American Bankers Association saying, President Obama, watch what you're saying. You're offending us. And as this all is unfolding, I don't think this one's a dog and pony show, Tom. Yeah. I think on the Hill and from people I've talked to both sides, they're tired. And if there's going to be taxpayers' money, there's going to be taxpayer protection. Yeah. So I think it's substance.
Interesting. We just had on a fellow from the Heritage Foundation talking about health care policy, and they're absolutely unwilling to go in the direction of maybe health care as a right, not a privilege, which is my thing. I think, I think we're not going to have any meaningful reform of any kind, regardless of what you call it, until we acknowledge that or we assert positively by force of law that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that there is a right to life in the United States, which means that if you're sick, you have the right to get healthy. And, you know, but in any case, he didn't go there. But apparently the Heritage Foundation is also making their rounds on some other issues.
They are, you know, with the health care, which is, you know, a huge failure of Congress to do anything. Speaker Hassert was horrible on it. But now the Heritage Foundation is talking about welfare reform and how it's going to be completely undone. Now, they have a certain issue about the mechanics, but they're saying it was put in the middle of the night and that, you know, it will completely undo the entire system. So one can question the process, but, you know, what really is going to be done by the Obama administration with it is really yet to be seen. It has not gone through the agencies, but they are making the rounds on warning that welfare reform as we know it is not existing now.
Is not existing.
It's going to be undone, in other words. What welfare reform was out there will be completely undone.
Well, in my opinion, that would be a good thing, because I think that the welfare reform that happened under the Clinton administration was, there were a few abuses that got corrected. But there are also a lot of people who are in need. I mean, the assumption at the time was that anybody who isn't working because they're just not, they don't have the initiative to get out there and get a job. Fact of the matter is, there ain't the jobs out there. I mean, we actually need that social safety net right now that Lyndon Johnson put into place.
Well, you know, I was on one of the shows with Heritage, and I understand the argument about the process, and let's open this up to a lot of discussions. I think, though, the generic statement that, you know, this is all undoing everything is a pretty broad brush. Yeah. The times change. What was good at that point in time, what President Clinton signed, may have evolved. So that's a debate Congress will get into with the Obama administration at the end of the day. Nothing stays pure and perfect when it comes to, you know, the economic times and how it changes it.
Yeah, you're right. We have a half a minute left, Bob. Your thoughts on the top stories in the news today?
Well, top stories in the news today, the statements by Bush's attorneys inside, 10 different things they said that the president could do, which was to basically be able to drag everybody off the streets at will. That was exposed by Attorney General Holder. That's the big story of the day.
I ranted for my entire first hour on that, and I think it's a huge one. I agree with you. Bob, I'm going to put you on hold here. Stick around. We'll be, and thank you so much for the report. Bob Ney, Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com. Our news alert for the day. Coming up, Katrina VandenHeuvel, a new book out, Meltdown. You're going to want to hear about this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
And now. Thanks for listening to the AM 620 KPOJ podcast, sponsored by the Better World Club. Providing travel services, auto insurance, and 24/7 nationwide roadside assistance, but not part of the highway lobby. This is Tom Hartman, Better World Club member since first moving to Oregon. Check out their eco benefits like the nation's only bicycle roadside assistance and their e-newsletter, Kicking Asphalt, at betterworldclub.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. Katrina VandenHeuvel ripping Karl Rove, a new one on ABC's This Week. This is absolutely brilliant.
It is. More money is going to be spent between 2011 and 2019 than is going to be spent this year to stimulate the economy.
But Mr. Rove, it is laughable to hear talk about fiscal responsibility from someone who helped plunge this nation into $1 trillion of debt through tax cuts for the very rich and a war we should never have fought.
So I'm saying
starving the beast, starving government has been a Republican role in terms of government. And therefore, when George asks why government hasn't functioned, people have not seen the role of government in improving the conditions of their lives for decades. Also, Democrats involved in starving the beast. Now is the time for investing in the future of this country. The GDP to debt ratio may be higher, but if it is for investment, for productive investments, not tax cuts for the rich or wars that have made us more insecure.
It is
brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Katrina VandenHeuvel, I bow in your presence. Welcome to the show.
Tom, you know, I want to say thank you for replaying that clip. But, you know, all of us for the last 8 years have looked with horror at what has happened to this nation. So when you sit across from Karl Rove, you know, it came naturally.
Yeah, well, it's...
It came naturally. And I mean, I received a lot of wonderful emails, but I feel I was a vehicle in some ways, a vessel for expressing what so many of us have felt and talked about.
You were channeling America, Katrina, and you did it brilliantly, and I want to honor you for that.
By the way, you
are, of course, the editor of The Nation magazine, thenation.com, and nationbooks.org as well. And your latest book, a compilation and an anthology, Meltdown, How Greed and Corruption Shattered Our Financial System and How We Can Recover. Tell us about the book.
You know, again, the book is a collection of Nation articles, and it shows that there were many in this country who were sounding alarm bells, Tom, for more than a decade about the perils of deregulation, of predatory lenders, rising economic inequality. And this book marks where we were, the warning bells, the roots of the crisis, and it lays out how we can recover. And it's with people like William Grider and Joseph Stiglitz, Thomas Frank, Robert Sherrill, Naomi Klein, and we're doing an event in New York City this Friday, a forum on meltdown and a people's recovery. I think if we don't understand the roots of this crisis, it's harder for us to see a way out,
yeah.
And that's what this book is designed to do.
Yeah, and people have to get it, you know, where this all came from. And really, in my humble opinion, and I've only written three books specific to the economy on this issue, you know, Unequal Protection and Screwed and We the People, and that it really began in the modern era with the election of Ronald Reagan. That's when the conservative meme that they've been pushing since the 50s actually got hold. I mean, during the 50s, Eisenhower wrote to his brother David, you know, these people are cranks. They're crazy. If they ever get in power, it'll destroy the Republican Party. But when Reagan came into office, they began this starve the beast, as David Stockman called it, policy. And we are now reaping the fruits of that.
That is so true. And this book lays out how the conservative right, beginning with Ronald Reagan, has worked hard to roll back the role of government, the ability of government to function. So when you hear this talk about how Obama is talking about a massive expansion of government, he's talking about dialing back, making government function, making it useful as a defender of the majority of American people. And what I thought was so important in the speech he gave last week, he talked about the role of government at times of other crises in this country, the Civil War, the New Deal, the Great Depression, how it has been a catalyst for economic renewal and development. And I think people have forgotten that, as you said, Tom, because we've seen government and what it can do to improve conditions of people's lives so beaten up, you know. So I do think we're at a moment where there's an opening. I don't know how you feel, Tom. I mean, the pain of this for millions of people is hard to witness, but
yes.
A crisis is a terrible thing to waste, and it is an opportunity to say, hey, you guys, conservative guys, your ideas are discredited.
Yeah.
We need to find a new way forward that makes more sense for our country.
No, they have absolutely destroyed our country. I mean, when Reagan came into office, we were the largest creditor nation in the world, and we were the largest exporter of manufactured goods in the world. We are now the largest debtor nation in the world, and we are the largest importer of finished goods. We used to import raw materials more than any other country in the world, you know, the iron ore and things like that. We'd turn it into finished products, and we'd ship it out when Reagan came into office in 81. And now we are the largest exporter of raw materials in the world, trash, trees, and you know, we're exporting cardboard, for God's sake, you know, waste cardboard and minerals, and more than 60% of our mining industry isn't even owned by Americans any longer.
Yeah.
And we are the largest importer of finished goods in the world. We have become, in 28 years, as a consequence of Reaganomics and trade policies that were continued, in fact even amplified enthusiastically by the Clinton administration, we have become the definition of a third world nation. What do we do?
Well, let me just point out that it is important to understand what has been done in our name. And you talked about Reaganomics. But one reason there are a few buffers in our system today and we're not seeing the Great Depression yet is because of reforms put in during the New Deal period.
Yep.
But we have in our book Meltdown, early on in 1999, when the Glass-Steagall Act, which was such an important protection for consumers and taxpayers, it was to divide commercial and investment banking and not allow these Citigroup monsters to form as they have since the repeal of that act, we warned it would lead to more risk in our system.
Yep.
Now, the architects of that, I fear, were, you know, Larry Summers and Bob Rubin presided over the passage of that. Now, they understand, because I think the conditions of the time are such that Larry Summers of 93 is not Larry Summers of today, that we need to re-regulate. Now, that's going to be important. But also going forward, I think, is the reinvestment in our country. So many people talk about the deficit, Tom, as you know, and you got to be careful. But the real deficit is the investment deficit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where Obama's budget begins to make a down payment on the radical underfunding of everything from education to health care to the needed investments in energy independence. So that's hopeful. But I'll tell you one thing. The one area where there needs to be more attention paid is this military budget. You know, we're the most powerful nation in the world. If we cut our military budget, and Barney Frank in our pages last week, Congressman Barney Frank, launched a call to cut $25 billion out of this $500 billion and counting military budget, we would still be the most powerful 10 times over.
Sure.
But until we really take that on, and it's not the best use of our taxpayer money to create jobs, as some think, it's going to be tough to see a real reallocation of the budget.
Yeah, but I think it's insane that we're trying to maintain an empire in a time and day when empire is gone. And if you want to argue that there are empires, actually the largest empire is the multinational corporations, who in aggregate are larger than any nation, and are exercising enormous power, economic power. And in some
the one piece of good news, Tom, may be that that may not be the case now, and certainly not in the future, because I think the shrinkage of that multinational empire is going on as we speak. And the hope, maybe, is that we come out of it with a system that is about real banks. Joseph Stiglitz has a piece in our next issue. Let's get these banks back to what they're supposed to be doing, and maybe make them even more decentralized, closer to the people they should be lending to, investing in, and not trading in this, you know, these exotic, quote, exotic instruments, which even some of those working with these instruments didn't even know what they were about.
Yeah, absolutely. We're talking with Katrina Vandenhoevel. She's the editor of The Nation magazine, thenation.com, the website. She's also the editor of a new book, Meltdown, How Greed and Corruption Shattered Our Financial System and How We Can Recover, with contributors William Greider, Robert Sherrill, Thomas Frank, Christopher Hayes, Barbara Ehrenreich, Kai Wright, and many others. Many of those folks have been guests on this program at various times. Katrina, in the minute that we have left, just to wrap this all up, your best overview of it seems to me that the thing that is preventing us from crashing like in the 30s is the social safety net left over from the New Deal. On the other hand, what we lack that we had during the 30s is we had manufacturing capacity then, and we by and large don't now, and we weren't in debt then and we are now. How do we walk the middle ground here?
It's a good question. It is a different world, and the global economic crisis is underway as we speak. I think we need real smart investment in this country, and that will begin to retool and rebuild. There will be a need to find new industries, and I think the investment in energy and the investment in a green economy, if we can do it without too much pain for workers, is a way to move from manufacturing as the base.
Right, and without too much pain from workers, I think we need to go back to a manufacturing base, but that's going to require a dramatic change
in our
trade
policy. But for high-speed rail, you know,
There you go. Katrina Vandenhoevel, thenation.com. Thank you so much, Katrina.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman here. Hey, guys. 21 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where despair is not an option, my friends. Get out there. Get active. And you got to bring up my board here. There we go.
Better take off your coat.
Oh, it's our full Monty alert.
Real slow.
Now, why does this one have to do with Harry Reid?
Baby, take off your shoes.
I think the Republicans have been tapping into David Vitter's fantasies.
Baby, take off your dress. Yes, yes, yes. You can't leave your hat on.
So you see, first of all, with the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, this is the stimulus package. The conservatives are running around saying, well, this is to spend money on grass. No. Then they said that Speaker Nancy Pelosi wants to save $30 million, spend $30 million to save a mouse. No. They completely made up this mythical high-speed rail line between Los Angeles and Nevada and Las Vegas. I mean, they just made it up out of whole cloth. And now they've elevated it to an even higher level. Congressman Trent Franks, the Republican from Arizona, took the lies to a whole brand new level with the help of Megyn Kelly on Fox News. He proudly proclaimed that the 2009 omnibus bill, well, here's what he said, and I quote, "The majority leader of the United States Senate, Harry Reid, has fought for this publicly and is committed to this project even in the face of criticism." Now, he was responding to Kelly saying, this is the woman from Fox News saying, quote, "It's a super railroad of sorts, a line that will deliver customers straight from Disney, we kid you not, to the doorstep of the Moonlight Bunny Ranch brothel in Nevada. I say to the Moonlight Bunny Ranch brothel in Nevada. So should your taxpayer dollars be paying for these kind of projects?" And Franks is just going right along with it, saying, yep, terrible, terrible, terrible thing. Well, sorry. Ain't no such thing. There's no high-speed rail there. There's no, nothing going on with the ranch. It's just, it's all the hallucinations of the Republicans. And I think, frankly, like I said, I think these guys are channeling David Vitter's fantasy life. The Republican U.S. senator who got busted with the D.C. madam and came back to the Washington, D.C. Disgraced to a standing ovation, believe it or not. Anyhow. David in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hey, David, welcome to the show. What's on your mind?
Yeah, good afternoon, Tom. I just wanted to comment on the E-Verify program that was summarily stripped from the stimulus bill back on February 11th during conference.
Right.
And I really feel like that was a utter betrayal of American and illegal immigrant workers because, you know, at a time when basically, 11 million Americans are out of work. The Congress basically decided to, do the bidding of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce over the interests, you know, of American workers. And I just think that was entirely, unjustified.
I agree with you, David. I agree with you. I have said over and over again, we don't have an illegal immigrant problem in the United States. We have an illegal employer problem in the United States. And this is a system that would have revealed those employers. In the course, it would have revealed people who are here illegally or who are not, you know, documented or however you want to say it. Right. It would have made it difficult for them to work. If they can't work, they would go back home and they would go through the proper and legal process as my sister-in-law, who just became a U.S. citizen just a few months ago, did. And it took a number of years. But, you know, she wanted to do it. It was worth it. God bless her. You know, she's now a U.S. citizen. I think that's a marvelous thing. And why should she and other people like her who go through the legal system be bumped out by people who don't? I mean, it's really simple. And the only answer that the Republicans have and a lot of Democrats have to that question is because, as you point out, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, a lot of the hard right and largely Republican think tanks and industry groups want there to be cheap labor. They want the cost of labor in the United States to go as low as it can. So if you bring in people who are not here legally, those people are vulnerable to employers who say, hey, listen, you're going to do it the way I said you're going to do it. You're going to work the extra 3 hours without pay. And if you don't, I'll turn you into the INS. They go, oh, okay, I'll work like that. And this is the exploitation of workers. You're absolutely right, David. It is so wrong what they're doing. And what's also so wrong, by the way, is that you've got a bunch of right-wing cranks who are taking that economic reality that I just talked about and that human tragedy, the human tragedies associated with it, because I'm all in favor of immigration into the United States or any other country, and I'm also all in favor of countries having membranes, as it were, to say, you know, we're here for this country. Speaking as somebody who was an expat, who, you know, I've lived and worked outside the United States on a couple of occasions. I lived for a year in Germany. I lived for a month in China. I've worked for, you know, weeks at a time or multiple weeks at a time over years in Africa and South America and in Australia, and have gone through the process of getting the permits when necessary or when appropriate. I think it's important that we recognize borders and countries be able to define their own economics. At the same time, I'm horrified by the guys on the right who try to turn this into some sort of race-baiting thing about, oh my God, be afraid of the brown people. That's not it at all. It's about what's right for the country.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Provider and licensing details are...
Back, Tom Hartman here with you, 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. But first, our Caught You Doing Something Right alert for the day. Yep, Marcy Kaptur, Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur, during today's House Budget Committee hearing, Congressman Jeb Hensarling, the Republican from Texas, repeatedly referred to the Democrat Party. The Democrat Party. So here's what Marcy Kaptur had to say in response to him. God bless her.
I begin by saying to my colleague from Texas that there isn't a single member on this side of the aisle that belongs to the Democrat Party. We belong to the Democratic Party, so the party you were referring to doesn't even exist. And I would just appreciate the courtesy when you refer to our party, if you're referring to the Democratic Party, to refer to it as such. We wouldn't say Republic Party in the instance of the party that you belong to, and I think that that really was unnecessary. I wanted to not on my time.
And I'm not even going to yield on my time. Done good. God bless you. That is absolutely marvelous. I am so pleased to hear Democrats with a spine. It's a marvelous thing, my friends. It's a marvelous thing. Bernice in Dearborn, Michigan. Hey, Bernice, welcome to the show. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi, Tom. I was thinking about the number 60 and what a critical number it is for us to have in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And we have 58 now. Possibly we'll have 59 with Al Franken. If Timothy Geithner's nomination were to be withdrawn, and as you know, Bernie Sanders and Russ Feingold both opposed his nomination.
Yes.
If he were taken out, and someone put in Bernie Sanders and Russ Feingold approved of, and that person would leave us with a Democratic senator rather than a Republican one, as Geithner's nomination did, then we'd have our 60. And we wouldn't have to go to the Republicans.
But see, you're talking about nominating a Republican for Attorney General.
Pardon me?
If you're talking about taking somebody out of the U.S. Senate and putting them like they tried to do with Judd Gregg and pull a Republican out, and so that, you know, from a state where the Democratic governor, or a state where the probabilities are, if they hold special elections, that a Democrat would be elected to replace them, then you're going to have an Attorney General who's a Republican. That's going to be a problematic situation.
Why can't we get rid of Geithner?
Well, because he's the Attorney General right now, and there's basically he can be fired by the president, or he can be impeached, but that's about it. I'm not even sure he can be impeached.
Yeah, I thought Geithner was Secretary of the Treasury.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. You're absolutely right. I'm sorry. I'm mixing people up. But, you know, same effect. He's a cabinet member. And as a member of the cabinet, he can only be withdrawn by the president. So, yes, thank you for correcting me. But the point is the same. And if you were to take a Republican senator and put him in there, you would have a Republican running the Treasury Department, which would be just as bad. It's the Republicans that got us into this mess. But I appreciate your thinking about it, Bernice. We've got to come up with some solutions here. I'm not sure that that's the best one. George, although maybe, I don't know. We'll see. George in Los Angeles. Hey, George, what's on your mind today?
Hey, everybody. I believe that the story about the disarray in the Republican Party, whatever they call themselves, I think that misleads the American people into thinking that they're not as strong as they would have been if they weren't in disarray.
Yeah.
I do believe that as long as the current president from the Democratic Party resorts to the kind of bipartisanship that he's talked about, we're just going to have more wars that are right-wing wars. And we're just going to have more big guy bailouts that are right-wing, thought as right-wing actions, and make me think that this government still is not representing the people, and the election of Obama really isn't representing the people of this country.
Yeah.
Whether it's for health care or politics or democracy in this country, we need to reform both.
Okay.
If we're going to have any kind of healthy democracy or healthy health.
Yeah, we do, George. We really do. You're absolutely right on that. With regard to how far Obama's going to go, and as Katrina VandeHeuvel said, you know, the Lawrence Summers of today is not the Lawrence Summers of before. I hope she is right on that.
Look,
they
all have a chance. They all had their chance. There are a lot of other people that can do things besides Lawrence Summers.
No, I agree with you, but he's the guy who's in there. So, you know, let's give him a few weeks at least before we start the circular firing squad here, George.
A lot of people don't have time for their jobs to be patient, and a lot of people don't have time in Afghanistan to be patient for whenever the war is going to escalate.
Yeah.
That is a problem. We don't have the luxuries that we supposedly used to have when Madoff was telling us everything was fine.
Yeah, the reality, George, and your point is well taken. The reality is we've never had those luxuries. And I agree with you. I think that Afghanistan is going to become Barack Obama's Vietnam. I think it's going to be a disaster if he continues down the road he's going. I don't want him to go down that road. But in any case, Steve in New York City, you wanted to disagree with me. You go to the front of the line. What's up?
Yeah. Here's why I disagree.
What do you disagree about?
You had said that the illegal immigration problem is not an illegal immigration problem. It's an illegal employer problem.
Yeah. What I wanted to say about it is that if we're going to criminalize this process, we should criminalize the magnets. We should criminalize the people who are inviting people to come to this country to work, because the people wouldn't be coming to this country to work if you didn't have companies inviting them. If you look at the history of the United States and illegal, in quotes, immigration from the 1800s, from the late 1800s, right up until the Reagan era, every year somewhere between a half a million and a million people would come north during fruit picking season and whatnot, mm-hmm. and then they would go back south again.
Right.
I don't
disagree with you in that regard. Okay. Here's where I think I'm not some right winger calling. I've talked to you before. Here's what I think the problem is. The problem is not the employers. It's not the people. The issue is that the United States needs to put its money where its mouth is and help these countries develop, help these peoples develop in their own countries, so there's no need for them to leave their own countries. And I would bet you that if somebody were to do an analysis and see, okay, how much money would it take for us to invest in these Central American countries to help them start farms, to help them start businesses, to help them have, you know, sustainable businesses there.
Yeah.
They wouldn't need to come here.
Here's two pieces to that. You know, let me agree with you, Steve, and let me just raise some issues that I think that you're raising.
Let me just say real quick, I agree with you what you were saying, that it's the employers who are the real culprits here, but I think that's not the problem. The problem is what I was saying, but yeah. I don't want you to think that I'm blaming immigrants.
I get it, and I appreciate it, and I appreciate a thoughtful discourse. And let's just explore this issue a little deeper, because here's part of the problem. Part of the problem with regard to immigration is that some of the best and brightest from Mexico and many other mostly Central American countries are now here.
Right.
You know, the entrepreneurs, the people who have a real, you know, I can do it. I'm going to step out there. I'm going to take a chance. I'm going to make for a better life. What did they do? They came to the United States. If they had stayed in Mexico, you know, if 10 million, 11 million people had stayed in Mexico, who were arguably some of the most, you know, enthusiastic, entrepreneurial and in many ways progressive citizens, I don't think that you would have the current president in Mexico. I think that the liberal candidate, whose name I'm forgetting now, would have won.
No, I know what you're talking about. He probably actually did.
As a matter of fact, yeah. You know, for a month there, you know, he tried to occupy the main square and all that kind of stuff. So, number one. Number two, the problem isn't that Mexico and other countries in South and Central America are collapsing or are not doing as well as we are because we're not providing them with aid. The problem is that they're collapsing or they're having problems. They're having economic problems, particularly a problem of a huge underclass, because they have been listening to the Chicago School economists, the Frederick von Mises, the Milton Friedman's, the Ronald Reagan's, the World Bank and the IMF have been extracting their pound of flesh. They loan the money and they say, okay, now you got to do away with your Social Security system. Now, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so you've got people, you know, the richest guy in the Northern Hemisphere is Carlos Slim. He's a Mexican. He's the richest guy in the Americas. And because Mexico is set up as a system where basically 36 or 38 families own more than half of all the wealth in that entire country.
Right.
And that's something that is not going to be affected by us throwing $30 billion in foreign aid or even $300 billion worth of foreign aid at Mexico. The country needs fundamental change. And I'm sorry we hit the break, Steve, but you know, your point is well taken. And I think that what we need to be doing is we need to be supporting. This is one of the reasons why I think that in Venezuela, in Ecuador, in Chile, in Argentina, the progressive movements that are happening in some of these countries, to the extent that they're happening, need to be encouraged. And we need to encourage that right across the board.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
You know, it's not pleasant to talk about.
Project.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those nets in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly real.
Tell them, Leonard. It takes a good Canadian to tell us Americans how it's doing. Just ask Sean, who's running the board, another good Canadian. Anyhow, here's heads up some of the things that I'll be doing over the next few days or few weeks or actually a couple months. March 7th, Saturday. That's this Saturday, isn't it? The 6th, by the way. Don't tell anybody because she doesn't want anybody to know, but the 6th is Louise's birthday. And the 7th we're going to Seattle, and we're going to be taking a three-hour cruise. I realize it's a three-hour tour in the song, but I like that. Anyway, a three-hour cruise with me and some of the folks and Louise and some of the folks from Talk 1090. That information is at am1090seattle.com. On March 19th, Thursday, I'll be in Chicago. We'll be doing the show live from there Thursday and Friday. And on Thursday, afternoon, I will be debating Michael Medved. This talk is sponsored by Chicago's Progressive Talk. And the website for tickets to that, please show up. We need a big peanut gallery and a lot of folks cheering on our side because he's getting them for his side. The website for that is Chicago's, with an S, progressivetalk.com. And then on May 2nd, Saturday, May 2nd, Denver, Colorado, I will be at the Green Festival. I'm one of the keynote speakers. And the information for that is greenfestivals.org/Denver. So check it out. Show up. Be there or be square and all that kind of stuff. Jay in Seattle. Hey, Jay, welcome to the show. What's on your mind today?
Well, hey, listening to you yesterday talking about Tom DeLay and talking about this Mexican issue today. And, you know, I became an independent about 2 years ago when I saw, in my opinion, and I think I'm right, that there's no difference between the Republican and the Democrat Party. And if you let
Well, there's no such thing as a Democrat Party. It's the Democratic Party.
The Democratic Party. There's no difference between these people, and people need to start realizing this. I mean, imagine
you're wrong.
Listen, man, let me finish. Imagine if all of a sudden everybody in your whole family and everybody you knew put blind faith in everything you said, and you knew that that was going to be the way it was. Look, you can look at Tom DeLay and you can say that he participates in the Chinese sweat camps and then all this and that, but you got to talk about the head of your party. It's either Pelosi or Boxer. I'm a little nervous right now. Look at where her and her husband made all their money. Same place.
I think you're talking about Dianne Feinstein, probability.
Yeah.
Her husband is the rich guy. Yeah.
Okay.
My point is,
listen, man, the Mexican situation, the Republicans use them for the jobs, the Democrats use them for the votes. They're both equally corrupt. They both equally abuse the hell out of the situation to their political gain.
Yeah.
Now, what would happen if all of a sudden in 2010, 2012, every single one of us registered ourselves as independents? Why can't we make these people realize that we're not going to just run around like a bunch of little lemmings? You Medved and Limbaugh, y'all take this time blaming everybody else.
You're making the case that Ralph Nader made.
No, I'm making the case that you know who made it. Ron Paul made it. He was the last.
Paul ran as a Republican.
But you know that was
and continues to run as a Republican
only because he had to.
No, he enthusiastically embraces it. He wants to take over the Republican Party and turn it into a more libertarian party. I saw Ron Paul just 2 days ago down in Washington D.C. He was speaking at CPAC. Ron Paul wants to turn the Republican Party into a libertarian party. He is doing the same thing that I advocate on the air, which is infiltrate a political party and take it over from the inside. I'm telling you, standing on the outside and complaining about a party when you probably, I'm betting, Jay, that you have never been to a local Democratic Party meeting or a local Republican Party meeting if you used to be a Republican. I'm betting you haven't been.
You're 100% wrong. I've been more involved in politics in my adult life than anybody that I know.
Then get a bunch of friends involved. I mean, we have to, or the Green Party for that matter. I mean, there are political parties out there that are actual and real and viable. And with these are democratic institutions. These are institutions you can take over. Jay, if you and I decided tomorrow that we didn't like the way that General Electric was reporting the news on MSNBC and NBC and you know the companies and the outlets that they own and the channels that they own, and we wanted to take it over, we'd have to raise hundreds of billions of dollars. But if enough of us decide that we want to take over the Democratic Party, all we've got to do is invest a few hours of our time every month.
Well, it'd be, in my opinion, one way to test that theory is, like I said, you could still vote Democrat, Republican, but if every single voter in America in 10 and 12 listed themselves and went and re-registered as independents.
You can't vote in the primaries and you can't make sure that good progressives get selected, or if you're a Republican, that decent Republicans get selected. You have to register with your party, particularly in those states with closed registration.
Exactly.
Jay,
Doesn't that scare you?
No, it's a good and healthy thing.
Conquer and divide. That's how they've taken societies apart before, is by conquering and dividing them. And look at us.
Jay, it is a good and healthy thing to have these political parties as completely open systems that you can join. And it's also a good and healthy thing to have closed primaries. The reason why the Republicans extracted this pound of flesh in this compromise down in California, where they said, okay, you want to have a budget passed, Democrats, you know, you need one Republican vote. You're going to have to put it to the people whether or not we're going to have open primaries, is so that the Republican Party can create mischief for the Democrats. I mean, you know, they've been doing it for years. As I, you know, I went through this a couple days ago about what happened in Michigan with Jack Kevorkian's lawyer, or for that matter, Michigan voting for Jesse Jackson for president and things like that. Michigan was the only state that voted for George Wallace for president in the Democratic primary. Why? Because Republicans crossed over to screw with the Democrats. If you're a member of a political party, that's a club that you've made a major commitment to, a major long-term commitment to, and you should have the right to have some say in that party. That's also, by the way, why I'm in favor of superdelegates in the Democratic Party. I think it's a good idea that 20% of them be superdelegates, because they're the people who really care. They're the people who put in their time and effort, and they should have an extra say. Coming up tomorrow, Dan Gaynor of the Business Media Institute. Nationalization? It's not just for communists anymore, he says. Oh, yeah, that'll be entertaining. And Dr. Jan Chosen-Bays is going to talk about mindful eating, rediscovering a joyful relationship with food, in our Best of Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Great shot, Bob.